Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money is John Maynard Keynes's landmark work in macroeconomics, first published in 1936. Written in the aftermath of the Great Depression, it challenged the classical assumption that free markets automatically return economies to full employment. Instead, Keynes argued that overall economic activity is driven by aggregate demand, and that economies can remain stuck in prolonged unemployment when private spending is weak. The book is not a simple policy manual. It is a theoretical reconstruction of how employment, output, interest rates, saving, and investment interact in a modern monetary economy. Its importance lies in changing the way governments, economists, and central banks think about recessions and stabilization. Many of the concepts now central to macroeconomics, including the consumption function, marginal propensity to consume, liquidity preference, effective demand, and the multiplier, are associated with this book and the Keynesian tradition it inspired. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, why Keynes rejected the idea of automatic full employment. The book begins by disputing a core classical belief that markets naturally self-correct and restore full employment after a disturbance. Keynes argued that this assumption ignores the possibility of persistent shortfalls in demand. If households and firms become cautious, total spending can fall below the level needed to employ everyone who wants work. In that case, prices and wages do not automatically solve the problem quickly enough. This is the book's most important conceptual shift because it relocates the source of unemployment from temporary friction to systemic demand failure. Keynes is not denying that markets function. He is arguing that they can settle into an equilibrium that is socially undesirable. By reframing unemployment as a macroeconomic problem rather than a simple labor market imbalance, he opened the door to policies focused on sustaining demand instead of waiting for adjustment to occur on its own. Secondly, aggregate demand as the engine of output and employment. A central argument of the book is that total spending in the economy determines how much output firms produce and how many workers they hire. Keynes called this the principle of effective demand. When demand is strong, firms expand production and employment. When demand weakens, they cut back. This makes consumption behavior crucial. Keynes highlighted the consumption function and the marginal propensity to consume to explain why incomes and spending do not move one for one. If additional income is only partly spent and partly saved, then demand may not grow enough to absorb available labor. The significance of this framework is that it treats the economy as interconnected rather than as a collection of separate markets. A drop in spending by one group affects income elsewhere, which then feeds back into further spending declines. The book therefore explains unemployment through a chain of demand, income, and production, rather than through a narrow labor supply analysis. Thirdly, investment, expectations, and the fragility of business confidence. Keynes gave special weight to investment because it is the most volatile component of demand. Business investment depends not only on interest rates but also on expectations about future profit, which can change suddenly. He described this through the marginal efficiency of capital, a measure of the expected return on new investment. When entrepreneurs become pessimistic, they may hold back even if borrowing costs are low. This helps explain why economies can remain weak after a shock. Private investment may not recover just because wages or prices fall. Keynes's analysis is therefore psychological as well as financial. He treated confidence, uncertainty, and expectations as real economic forces rather than side issues. This makes the book especially important for understanding crises, when investors often behave defensively and reinforce downturns. In Keynes's framework, unstable expectations can cause recessions to deepen unless some other force, often the state, steps in to support demand and restore a more stable environment for investment. Fourthly, interest rates, liquidity preference, and the limits of monetary policy. The book offers a distinctive explanation of interest rates through liquidity preference, the idea that people hold money partly because they value safety and flexibility. Interest rates are not simply the reward for saving. They are shaped by the public's desire to keep assets liquid. This matters because it weakens the classical view that central banks can always stimulate the economy by lowering rates. Keynes argued that in some circumstances, especially when rates are already very low, monetary policy may lose traction. This is the logic behind the liquidity trap, where extra money creation does not translate into more lending or spending, because people prefer to hold cash. The significance of this argument is practical. It shows why reducing interest rates alone may be insufficient in a severe downturn. It also explains why Keynes placed so much emphasis on combining monetary policy with fiscal action. In his view, interest rates are one important lever, but not a guaranteed solution to mass unemployment. Lastly, why the book became a blueprint for fiscal activism and modern macroeconomics. The general theory is influential not only because of its ideas, but because of its policy implications. Keynes argued that governments should actively manage demand, especially during recessions, through public spending, taxation, and monetary coordination. If private spending collapses, public spending can fill the gap and prevent unemployment from becoming entrenched. This made the book a major intellectual foundation for counter-cyclical policy, the New Deal era, and later stimulus responses to economic crises. It also helped define modern macroeconomics as a discipline separate from classical price theory. The book is challenging because its argument is distributed across concepts and relationships rather than presented as a neat policy handbook. But that complexity is part of its originality. It does not merely recommend intervention. It explains why intervention may be necessary when markets fail to generate enough demand. That combination of theory and policy relevance is what makes the book endure as a foundational text. In conclusion, this book is best suited for readers who want to understand how modern macroeconomics was formed and why governments came to see recessions differently after the Great Depression. Economists, students of public policy, historians of ideas, central banking professionals, and general readers with an interest in economic thought will all benefit from it. Though patience is required because the writing is dense and highly theoretical, its practical value lies in showing how consumption, investment, interest rates, and expectations interact to shape employment and output. Its intellectual value lies in breaking with the older belief that markets always self-correct quickly and fully. Compared with many economics books, it stands out because it is not simply descriptive or technical. It is a foundational rethinking of how economies function at the level of the whole system. That is why it remains relevant in debates over stimulus, austerity, unemployment, and monetary policy. Readers come away not with a list of formulas alone, but with a framework for interpreting economic downturns and the role of the state in responding to them. If you would like to support John Maynard Keynes, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.